I would like to reflect today upon the founding of our nation with a little bit of history, and I would like to encourage all of you to develop an interest in history because we are facing an age of revisionism, where people are rewriting our history, and our history is being stolen. Today, I'm going to delve into the life of George Washington and some of the events that surrounded the founding of our nation. George Washington has, in the last few decades, been presented more and more as an agnostic, as a man who didn't believe in God or have a strong faith. Nothing could be to the contrary, because we have his own writings. I'll read to you. His writings would strongly point to a strong faith. And then we have the writings of the witnesses, those who served under him and watched him and knew him. These are the kind of men who founded our nation, men of faith and character, and founded upon the principles, biblical principles. Character matters. It certainly mattered in the case of George Washington. He was born on February 22nd, 1732, in Virginia. His father died when he was 11 years old, but even in those 11 years, there had been some experiences that shaped his life. On one occasion, his father had planted cabbage seeds in an order that when they came up, they spelled George. And he said to his son, "George, I wonder how that happened." And he says, "I don't know." His father said, "Well, it must just have been coincidence. It's the only thing I can think of." George, though, was young. He said, "No, you did it." So his father encouraged him to always look around at the skies and the plants and the animals and see the order with which the Creator had placed in the creation, and you would see his signature. His faith developed from a young age and matured. When, at the age of 11, his father died, his older brother Lawrence became a father figure in his life and became his mentor in life. George, in his teenage years, had a hot temper. It could flare like that, even on into his early 20s, because at the age of 21, he became a surveyor. And he accumulated land. That was his big desire, to become a landowner. And when he was frustrated, he could lose his temper. But we have his own writings that tell how he saw that temper as a weakness, and that with God's help, he wanted to learn how to control his temper, because it didn't help him. It didn't help him if he was commanding people. It didn't help him if he was under stress. And when he came to the prime of his life, leading the Revolutionary Continental Army, he was a man who was known for self-control. Amazing feat that a lot of us could take a lesson from. He began his military career as a young man fighting in the French-Indian War, which lasted about 5 years. What characterized Washington was so many mistakes that he made, incredible mistakes. But after it was all over, no one questioned his bravery, his perseverance, his tenacity, and his character and integrity. Even though they had made terrible mistakes, suffered defeats, he gained the respect of his men. And in 1775, events were beginning to happen in this country that were going to change the future. King George sent 1,000 British soldiers to America with orders to confiscate weapons, take them away. Wherever you find weapons, and in 1775, people need weapons to hunt, but they were confiscating them, and anyone suspected of being a revolutionary leader was to be arrested. But that didn't set too well with militia. So the first battles of the revolution were not fought with a Continental Army. They were fought by local militia in places like Lexington and Concord. In those two battles alone, over 300 British soldiers died. Later, there was a battle in Massachusetts called Bunker Hill, where the British suffered 1,000 casualties and the militia about half that. So by June 19th, 1775, Washington is asked to form a national army to fight the British. The war began not with victorious victories, but with a series of defeats and retreats. It wasn't long. The six-year war had ground into the first couple of years, whether anyone wondering whether or not there would be any possibility of victory. A man by the name of Thomas Paine, who had this incredible ability to think, some of the best thinkers there were lived during this time. And incidentally, you don't have to have all the fanciest places of environment to write. He wrote these words using a drum for a desk. They were later printed and sold 500,000 copies. His words were inspiring to the entire nation, and especially to George Washington and the troops. Here's an excerpt. "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph." Those are inspiring words that came at a tough time. At one of the lowest times in the war, George Washington knew that if there was going to be any survival, he needed a victory. And that victory came at Trenton, New Jersey, when he attacked the Hessians, German mercenaries. These weren't mercenaries for individual money. These were mercenaries for the King of Germany. He sent over 20,000 of them. These poor guys were drafted and didn't get any money, and the King got all the money back in Germany. So there were 20,000 of them, and in Trenton, New Jersey, there were about 4,000 of them. But on that particular night, which I believe by the providence of God, there only happened to be 1,500 of them. Two other separate portions of those soldiers hadn't returned. Washington made it across with his 2,500 men across a frozen river, barely getting across. Two other generals were supposed to join him. The ice was too thick and they couldn't make it. They had to turn back. With just 2,500 men and an 8-mile walk, they surprised the Germans. No loss of life to the Americans, except two died in the march there. They captured the German soldiers. And this became a victory that inspired the revolutionary cause. What George Washington had to do all the way through this six-year war was inspire his men to re-enlist. It became one of his greatest challenges. Here's a portion of a speech, because their enlistments would be for 2 years, 18 months, 2 years. They would expire and the men would leave, and the ranks would be depleted, or they suffered so many defeats that they would desert, and his numbers were constantly falling far beneath the levels of the enemy they were facing. Here's a portion of a speech where he is encouraging men to stay. "My brave fellows," he said, "you have done all I ask you to do, and more than could be reasonably expected, but your country is at stake, your wives, your houses, and all that you hold dear. You have worn yourselves out with fatigue and hardships, but we know not how to spare you. If you will consent to stay only 1 month longer, you will render that service to the cause of liberty and to your country, which you probably never can do under any other circumstances. The present is emphatically the crisis which is to decide our destiny." The drums beat a second time for the men to come and re-enlist. The soldiers felt the force of the appeal. One soldier said to another, "I will remain if you will." Another remarked, "We cannot go home under such circumstances." This was an ever-going battle. It took a man of tremendous courage and persuasion. I'd like to give you what is a classic example of the kind of man who we consider to be the founder of our nation, who led this army and defeated the greatest army in the face of the earth, the British Army. Incidentally, one of the things that helped Washington understand that the British could be defeated, and that is during the French and Indian War, he had British soldiers fight underneath his command. And when they were fighting the French and the Indians, the French and the Indians fought guerrilla warfare. They would come out, fight, and then disappear. And they had smaller numbers, and Washington had larger numbers, and they decimated his army, and he saw the British run. Turn tail and run. And he came back saying, "How is it possible that the greatest army on the face of the earth ran from those Indians and ran from those French soldiers?" Even though it was defeat, it planted in his mind when he was leading an army, they will run under the right circumstances. And who do you think developed the first warfare in the United States of guerrilla warfare against the British? It was George Washington. He learned it from the Indians. And though he was criticized and condemned and held in contempt by all the British generals because he didn't know the etiquette and the fine strategy of war, he fought like savages. They won battles and ultimately won the war. When he was a young man, his older brother Lawrence had asked him to go with him to Barbados because Lawrence was suffering from tuberculosis and he had heard that he could find a cure there. So George accompanied him on that journey. Lawrence didn't find a cure for tuberculosis, but George Washington contacted smallpox and was sick for a couple of weeks, but recovered. And during Valley Forge, when so many suffered and died from smallpox, he had been inoculated to it. The hand of God was upon his life in so many ways. Here's an example of his character. In 1776, he wrote a letter to Congress asking for unprecedented power to execute maneuvers without waiting for approval. Here's a portion of his letter. "It may be said that this is an application for powers that are too dangerous to be entrusted. I can only add that desperate diseases require desperate remedies, and with truth declare that I have no lust after power, but wish with as much fervency as any man upon this wide extended continent for an opportunity of turning the sword into a plowshare. But my feelings as an officer and a man have been such as to force me to say that no person ever had greater choice of difficulties to contend with than I have." Congress answered his letter, giving him unprecedented power. He could, wherever his army went, he could ask that citizen to sell him in continental scrip money what they had. If they refused, they could take it. If they caused problems, they could arrest the person. No president or general has ever been granted those powers that wide. Here was General Washington's answer to Congress. "Instead of thinking of myself freed from all civil obligations by this mark of confidence, I shall constantly bear in mind that as the sword was the last resort for the preservation of our liberties, so it ought to be the first to be laid aside when those liberties are firmly established." That only heightens our respect for the man. At Valley Forge was the lowest part of the six-year war. Washington arrived there with 2,500 men, and before the winter was over and they were ready to leave, over 30% of the soldiers would die. They built these little huts that housed 12 men. About 2,000 men didn't have blankets during the cold winter. They didn't have food, they didn't have clothes. It was the darkest moment. How could anyone with such a ragtag army ever defeat this huge, powerful British army? A few hundred miles away lay in Virginia was General Howe, with an army more than capable of wiping out General Washington. All his advisors, all his counselors said, this is the moment. They're too weak. We have reports that they're sick. They don't have food. They don't have blankets. This is the moment. But it was a cold winter, and even General Howe liked his comfort, and he says, let's wait for spring. But that would be too late. One of the greatest criticisms that I have heard these revisionists, because I often read the history as it is revised, so I know what they're saying about our founding fathers. One of the greatest criticisms leveled against our founding fathers, including Washington, is that they did not put into our founding documents something about slavery, that slavery is abolished, that we had to wait till our 16th president and have a war that claimed 500,000 lives before we could get rid of slavery. So this is the huge, huge criticism. It's amazing, I think, that the state of Rhode Island was the first to say that any slave who joined in the Revolutionary War would receive their freedom at the end. And then all the states joined after that, and George Washington accepted that. Nearly 1,000 slaves were fighting in the Revolutionary War. In that time, there could have been a mutiny against George Washington actually doing that. He himself freed his slaves on the death of his wife, Martha. But the war became long and drawn out, 6 years. It changes, it grows, it wanes. There was always a decisive time to make a move. And that time came when George Washington was deciding that he should take his army to New York and attack. But his generals were asking him to go to Yorktown. That would be the place to attack. But he couldn't make sense of it, and he wasn't a man to make a quick decision. He deliberated, he listened. But as far as he was concerned, that's where they were going, to New York. A French general who was working with him, named Rochambeau, came to him and he said, I know what your generals are saying to you, and I agree with them. We should attack Yorktown. General Washington said, if we attack Yorktown, that fort is so heavily defended, the only thing that we can accomplish is have several hundreds of our men die, and we will never capture the general or his men. And I refuse to do that. They can always get on their ships and leave. The French general said, well, what if you had a navy? He said, I am listening. So the French general reached into his satchel. He pulled out a dirty piece of paper that had never been opened, still had the seal, and he opened it up. And he says, this comes from Admiral Grassi, who has just left from the West Indies with 29 warships and 3,000 men aboard. They will be here in 3 days. What would you say to that, General Washington? And he said, I would say, let's make plans to go to Yorktown. You see the hand of God in so many ways, because the French admiral arrived with his 29 warships, and at the same time, the admiral of the British arrived from New York with almost the same amount of warships, and they started duking it out right there on the, I don't actually think you say that on the ocean, but they were fighting each other, not a full-scale war, but they would put two or three ships at each other trying to conserve. And all of a sudden, this huge, massive storm moves in. They have to stop fighting, and it batters the ships. And when the ships are, when they survey the damage, the British, their biggest ship has to be sunk because they're afraid the French might take it. And 20 of their ships are damaged so bad they can't even fight. So they have to turn tail and go back to New York, leaving the French ships, which were completely undamaged in the storm, only a few miles apart. Pretty remarkable, wouldn't you say? The French ships surround Yorktown. And of course, in less than 1 month, it only took 3 weeks for that Battle of Yorktown, for General Cornwallis to surrender. Such a proud and arrogant man, he had announced that wherever General Washington's attacks, if he attacks here, there will never be a victory and there will never be a defeat because he cannot defeat us. The British Navy will take us away. It didn't happen that way. And he refused to come out himself to surrender to George Washington. After the war was over, there were two major hours where this nation was tottering on just a spider web as to whether or not it was really going to survive. The first one is called the Newberry Conspiracy, one of the most dangerous hours in our history. A group of officers were very discontent that they hadn't received their pay. Certainly, Washington had done everything he could to tell them that I know the men in Congress, they are honorable men, and that you will get your pay. It's just not there. They're broke. But that wasn't good enough for these men. They determined to cause a mutiny. And they actually purported that we are going to do something, but we want our money now. We will fight, or if an enemy attacks, we won't defend the nation. It was very scary. They actually wrote a letter. It was an anonymous letter. They asked George Washington to be crowned king so that he could solve the problem. Here's a little bit of what he arrived to speak to this group in Newburgh, New York. The world turned upside down. The power and goodness of the Almighty were strongly manifested in the events of our late glorious revolution, and his kind of interposition in our behalf has no less visible in the establishment of our present and equal government. In war, he directed the sword, and in peace, he has ruled in our councils. My agency in both has been guided by the best intentions and a sense of the duty which I owe my country. Now he directly speaks about this anonymous letter. Perhaps the strongest feature in his character was prudence, according to Thomas Jefferson. Because as he spoke to those men, he said, the man who wrote the letter and the man who leads this conspiracy can be nothing but a traitor after the sacrifice that we have given ourselves. The conspiracy was put down. The second major crisis that faced the nation after winning the war and after settling this issue of the Newburgh conspiracy. And I think that is really amazing that George Washington was offered to be king. I mean, we're seriously talking about being king, and he actually turned that down to want to go back to be a farmer. Just think about that for a moment. First, he is given the power when he is general to arrest anybody, all the power in the world, and yet he did not abuse that. He turned it back as soon as it was over. He is now asked to be coronated king, and he refuses to take it. In fact, he disdains even the idea and rebukes the men who are purporting this and settles the mutiny. He says they are no friend of his or no friends of the nation, and the idea is insidious. Amazing, amazing events. The second event, though, that becomes absolutely incredible, and that is whether or not this nation can form a constitution. We have in the United States Constitution one of the most marvelous documents that, in my opinion, and in others far more educated than I, has the hand of God behind it. It was an incredible document. The Declaration of Independence is an incredible document that we celebrate on this day. But the Constitution followed in 1787, after the war. The creation of this document, which details the kind of government we had, There was a huge controversy that developed. You can imagine, there were 13 colonies, and it took 4 months to work out this controversy. Every day they were working out, trying to come to some kind of agreement, and there was a big state, little state controversy. Rhode Island was refusing to participate whatsoever because they were mad like a little child. If we can't print money, and they had decided no state would be able to print money, they said, if we can't print our own money, we're not coming. So they stayed home. New Hampshire was just, nobody knew where they were, just kind of lazy getting to the place. So the other 11 were there. Here were the big states: Virginia, Massachusetts, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina. And they were ruling the day. Here were the little tiny states: Connecticut, Delaware, New Jersey, New York. The big states said, we want two houses of government, and both of them shall be based on population. You shall have as many representatives based on, originally said 40,000, and they changed it to 30. So one representative per 30,000. And in the Senate, it will be exactly the same way. That's what the big states said, because we don't see ourselves as equal with you little bitty states over here. So one was called the Virginia Plan. That was the plan to allow the big states to carry more weight, have more authority. But the Connecticut Plan, which came from a little state, was why not make all the states equal, they have two senators, so in the Senate we'll all be equal, but over here in the House of Representatives we'll be represented by population. For 4 months they voted an innumerable amount of times. They could not pass. It seemed as if it would never happen. Again here, it is George Washington and his influence and his respect that he works to try to bring some kind of compromise. James Madison, who is a protege of George Washington, is one of the main designers of the Constitution, and he signs this document. He doesn't represent anyone but himself and his intellectual ability to formulate it. He was for this large state view. Washington helps him see that a compromise is needed because we are on the verge of losing everything we fought for. Finally, the vote comes. The two, Rhode Island and New Hampshire, they're still not there. And they finally pass what we have today. A Senate which makes all the states equal and the House represented. It's been an incredible system that has been copied all around the world. But I just like you to see what we don't know because of the years behind us, how close it was to not even happen. The little states would have been ruled by the big states. They would have traded tyranny of Europe for the tyranny of America. And God gave us an incredible system. The moment that Washington, after the vote, he summoned the delegates geographically north to south to advance. He actually holds this Constitution of the United States in his hands. He signed it first, inscribing his name with a flourish. Hamilton signed too, though he represented no one but himself. Pennsylvania Governor Morris hobbled forward on his wooden peg leg to sign. When Georgia's delegates, including Colonel Few and Major Pierce, had finished, Washington commended the delegates for their accomplishment. But with this warning, should the states reject, because it had to be ratified, should the states reject this excellent Constitution, he said, the probability is that an opportunity will never again offer to cancel another in peace. The next will be drawn in blood. It was ratified. And his influence in getting this compromise through in these four grueling months, and his influence with all the states because of being such a beloved hero, caused this ratification. Otherwise, we may have never seen our government fully formed. Later, he wrote a letter to a Frenchman, Marquis de Lafayette, and he says, little short of a miracle, a few short weeks will determine the political fate of America for the present generation and probably produce no small influence on the happiness of society through a long succession of ages to come. Should everything proceed with harmony and can sin according to our actual wishes and expectations. I will confess to you sincerely, my dear Marquise, it will be so much beyond anything we had a right to imagine or expect 18 months ago that it will demonstrate as visibly the finger of providence as any possible event in the course of human affairs can ever designate it. As you can see from George Washington's writings, he knew God's hand was upon the events of the founding of our nation. So it's only fitting that on this Sunday, where we're celebrating the independence of our nation, our 238 years of existence, that we, with thankful hearts, look back in history and see a little bit of what happened to give us this country. And help us with dogged perseverance to hang on to our liberties and our freedoms, which haven't come to us easily, and we shouldn't let them go easily. Please stand with me. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this nation. We know that it was founded by your hand, and we believe that it is an exceptional nation, regardless of what others think or don't think. We know in our